Cool. Okay. Well, yeah, thank you all for coming, for hanging through to the end of a really full, interesting day. Yeah, it's nice to be on this panel as well, with defining myself in a room with people who are interested in phenomenological interviews and who have done phenomenological interviews. I think it's a really interesting and exciting way of doing phenomenology. It seems really relevant to me in the context of this conference, because I think phenomenologists, kind of like Freudians, are often caught a bit of a bad rap because have historically aimed for what we claim might be universal, and it might just tell us more about the lives of middle class Viennese people or Parisians or Exonians than it does about most of humanity. So it's overwhelmingly good that we branch out as phenomenologists. It's not just to the things themselves, but to the people, the experiences who themselves are experiencing these things, that we can enrich, I guess, the field of experience beyond their own introspective lives and the biases that we might not know that we bring to it. But of course, such engagement brings to it several problems, both ethical problems and also hermeneutical, which is what I want to talk about today. Now, hermeneutically, the problem is easily put. Phenomenological interviews involve interpreting another subject's experiences. So at least some of the time, and perhaps always in some sense, this might suggest, or even appear to suggest, that the interviewer themselves somehow knows better or somehow sees deeper than the interviewed subject does. And this is not necessarily problematic, but from the ethical side, of course, raises several difficult questions a bit about power, authority, and truth. Indeed, there's a shift in qualitative research, and you see this in our conference theme, but also in other disciplines like anthropology, to really treat research subjects as partners in the exploration. So we're not just exploring them or mining them for data so that we can understand better. But it's not so simple to do that. It's one thing to say you want to really collaborate with a subject that you're interviewing, but it's another thing to actually make that meaningful from both sides. So I want to explore these themes in the context of my current research project, which is about musical improvisation, and in which phenomenological interviews play a central role in the kind of data that I'm working with in particular. So just a quick outline before I get into the tricky questions. I'll just start by introducing my project and talking a little bit about our interdisciplinary methodology. And I'll talk in a little bit more detail about phenomenological interviews as I'm practicing them. And then I'll get onto the more juicy stuff about the tricky issues we might have in interpretation of other people's, or of the interviews themselves. But those challenges can be summarized in these two key questions to put up. So, asking at what points the lived experience accounts, the actual experience to which the subject is attached, reach limits that might be better informed by critical distance or historical context consciousness? And secondly, is it essential to reconcile any contradictions that we find between these levels of analysis? For example, between the phenomenological take and the psychological take and the everyday understanding, between the researcher's cultural interpretation and the subject's personal understanding. And however we answer that second question gives us two difficult follow-up questions as well. We answer yes, we are confronted with how we give weight to values like truth while doing justice to these two different lived realities. And if we answer no, can we avoid re-perpetuating those power imbalances of the researcher saying, well, I know better in some way, which is often present. And just as a caveat, I don't believe I have a final answer to any of these. I've kind of brought these along to this conference to throw on the table. I'm very interested to hear what you might think and how you might answer these questions. This is the context of which you grew out of. For context, I'm working on an artistic research project called Musical Improvisation and Ethics. We're looking at the ethical phenomena that arise during acts of group improvisation. And so what's ethical about music, you might ask? Why is that a phenomenological question? Well, we had a really interesting discussion earlier today on in this room about how to dress like a feminist. And when I share that view that they have, that ethics is not necessarily morality, it's not good or bad. We're not asking whether the musicians are nice to each other or not, or what's the best way to do that, but talking rather about ethics in the broader sense, what Charles Taylor calls frameworks or horizons. So what are actually the conditions for make something show up to us as good or as bad? What makes something appear worthwhile to us? So there's this interesting interblending, as with fashion, you know, of ethics, aesthetics, and politics as expressions. How do these different things come together to embody the good life and express Express the Good Life. So this gives us all these questions of how aesthetic tastes encode and carry ethical values. And central importance here is the background understanding that colors our experience of performing. These are always colored by our habits, which we develop through being encultured, through being initiated into a certain form of life, a certain practice. So some things will appear to us through either our historical culture, through our musical subculture, as being beautiful or interesting or worthwhile. But investigate this, I'm working with a composer, Christopher Williams. He's an artistic researcher and composer, and an anthropologist, Caroline Gatt. And we're working through a series of what we call musical labs with three large improvising ensembles. Might skip over too much about what we do inside the labs just for the sake of time, but we can talk about that later if anyone's interested. But essentially the aim is we're using things like these creative scores. We're sort of throwing things in the way of the improvisers, asking them to work as they would normally work. But I guess in this, with this phenomenological assumption that if you interrupt someone's way of working, it becomes more visible both to them and to you. And then we can talk more about it and investigate what motivates them. And the kind of ensembles we're working with are quite diverse. There's this is a Trondheim Jazz Orchestra, a few members there. So they're a large pool of very good, well-trained jazz musicians. There's a large group of 21 avant-garde improvisers in Berlin who have very interesting politics. And yeah, it's good fun. There they are, having fun there. Right, so the business, the phenomenological interviews. So the aim of the phenomenological interview is to apply the phenomenological attitude to another's experience. So I won't use too much time mansplaining the concept of reduction or FK to this crowd. But the simple idea is that rather than reflecting phenomenologically on one's own experience, the phenomenologist, through a series of targeted and probing questions, draws out experience from a subject. So using interviews in phenomenological research has a long pedigree. Jaspers recommended them about 100 years ago. There's a specific interview technique. It's been developed closer to our time. Work of people like Yogi, Petit-Monjean, Smith and Larkin, and many others over the past 20 years or so. And perhaps unsurprisingly, interviews and applied phenomenology have been used more predominantly in medical or psychiatric contexts, but increasingly they're being brought into enriching accounts of the arts, of dance, music, of course, and sport, as well as the various acts of embodied social acts, embodied acts, things which go beyond rational introspective thinking. So Simon Hufting and Christian Martini describe this process as a two-tier account. And for them, and this is broadly informs how I've been working as well, the phenomenological interview has two distinct steps. So the first step is the actual interview itself. This is sitting down with a subject and asking probing open questions, leading them to offer detailed descriptions of the experience that you're interested in. And the subject here might not, realistically probably is not, trained in phenomenology themselves. So the interview requires a certain subtlety. Rather than asking them to bracket judgments themselves,
we're just having some online issues. I need to share the screen again, and hopefully it's going to work this time.
Sure. Okay. So, rather than asking subjects to bracket judgments, we might use follow-up questions to zero in on the specific details, the what it's like of your concern. We can repeat questions in slightly different ways, giving them space to describe their experience from different angles. Thank you. So I personally find it fruitful to ask questions, what does it feel like? Or how do you know this? In my own work in musical improvisation, I frequently run into the answer, well, it's just intuitive. You ask me, how do you know when to begin playing? And I'll say, well, it's just intuitive. But of course, that very sense of intuition, that's the phenomena that I want to unravel. So it's helpful to use these concepts and things as prompts to push it a little bit deeper. There's also a delicate balance in my experience between leading your subject towards a phenomena and then priming them or inadvertently biasing them with your own focus. I don't think this can be avoided altogether, and it's not necessarily problematic. If I'm interested in the phenomenology of deep listening, it seems fine to steer the conversation back towards that from a digression into personal history, back to the things themselves, as it were. But I think it's important to be aware of this, of the situated context of the life and the people you're working with, particularly how these things are being experienced. In the second tier, in Hofting and Martini's account, is actually the phenomenological analysis. And here the researcher takes the interviewee's description and then actively performs a phenomenological reduction. which involves taking the description seriously as a first-hand account of experience, perhaps also with a grain of salt, since we only really accept that experience as an approximation, what we understand of what they understand. But the tension comes here in the transition between the two tiers. In the first tier, we just accept the subject's account more or less as it is. And of course, we probe, we seek clarification, bring contradictions to their attention and help them refine it. But essentially, we're looking for their lived experience. And I think the current emphasis on lived experience throughout the humanities owes public discourse more broadly owes a lot to this phenomenological attitude. But in the second tier, this is where it starts to get tricky. We claim an expertise that allows us to critique this very lived experience. So we reserve the right to interpret it and to dispute it, and even in some cases to refute it, which is not to deny, of course, not to deny the subject's own reality, but at the very least to draw attention to discrepancies between that subjective experience and between our shared public understanding, particularly with scientific discourse. This is all a bit abstract at the moment, but it might help to give a more concrete example. So a big interest of mine at the center of this project is what I've been calling the improvising mindset. And this is a particular state of consciousness with phenomenological similarities to what people call flow states, what Höfting calls musical absorption. There's important differences between all of these terms, but phenomenologically, it's characterized by a strong sense of intersubjectivity, by heightened perception, by altered senses of control and decision-making, and often different senses of time consciousness or awareness. And so how to understand this mindset and its overlap with the slippery concept of flow, these are open questions. But going to the things themselves, it's something that comes up a lot in the interviews I've been doing. Usually spontaneously, people will just bring it up, and it's obviously of clear emotional importance to the performers. It's often a key motivation for why it is that they do what they do. But of course, these emotional experiences can have very different cultural interpretations. So for example, the first group I worked with was a Norwegian jazz ensemble. Almost all of them were raised the concept of flow on their own. I didn't ask them about it, but they brought it up. And it was a really significant element of their experience, but their attitude towards it was quite thoughtful and secular. They always seemed a bit embarrassed about having it and about describing it. So they would always preface their descriptions with things like, I'm not a spiritual person, but or, I don't really believe this, but it's like this, describing this strange sense of embodiment that they would have. The second group I worked with was much more cosmopolitan. They were more avant-garde, based in Berlin, but they're from many different nationalities and many different language groups and cultures. And their artistic practices formed a much deeper part of their broader spiritual identity. So they weren't only shy to embrace a more spiritual language to discuss their musical experience, but they talked really passionately about their intersubjective experiences. They'd use words like telepathy, not only with their fellow players, but also with the non-human world and other things around them. This raises really interesting questions when it comes to actual comparison. So my way of working has been to interview all of the musicians at sort of quite length and then transcribe it and look for phenomenological similarities across it. And when we come to interpreting it, I guess we get between these two different sort of cultural interpretations between the groups, it starts to raise these interesting tensions. Now, the first tier and the interview level, it's not necessarily problematic because I'm only interested in the things themselves. So we take the descriptions as raw data. We're interested in phenomena, not interpretation. That's the point. But then such bracketing also, it passes over some things which are really essential part of some of these people's identities. Maybe the problem comes with the shift to the second tier. Now, again, at first glance, there's nothing necessarily problematic here. As phenomenologists, we want to bracket judgment. Perhaps we want to reframe. I might go away and say, well, maybe this is less a phenomenology of musical absorption to a phenomenology of spiritual state. But I think we really start to run into difficulties at that next stage when we're comparing them. The very motivation for bracketing in the first place, for taking that sort of step back, is to discern common underlying features. So what is it that unites these experiences? So phenomenology, as I've been taught and as I practice it, has some certain commitment to the universal. I don't mean a kind of view from nowhere universality, no blank slates or faux objectivity. Certainly a strong appreciation for a cultural diversity, but also a recognition that our shared embodiments support a working hypothesis that there's something universal about the structures of experience, and it's finding where where to draw that line, where we move from body to culture is something that I think we're all asked ourselves about and are working on. They're confronted by two similar experiences that take on different cultural interpretations. Phenomenologists are eventually forced to make a choice. And however we caveat it, we find ourselves asserting, at least implicitly, that there's something in lived experience can be understood differently. So I'm going to reconcile these experiences. I have to give priority to one, or possibly to neither. Perhaps I'll suggest that my own explanation, that's slightly distanced from these realities, might be a better way to explain it. In any case, my whole methodology is presuming that these experiences, which are phenomenologically similar but interpreted differently, are species of the same phenomena. And this might seem like a small import when we're talking about some strange music created by fairly culturally similar people. In a more loaded example, if you look at the experience of things like gender, different cultures or different subcultures are going to interpret very similar phenomenological experiences in maybe radically different ways. And so for phenomenologists, I think these different interpretations suggest that there's something prior to the experience, which is at least worth investigating. So again, this brings us to the big questions. At what points does this lived experience accounts reach limits that might be better informed by critical distance, by historical consciousness? A simple answer to this one might be, at what point? Well, right here in tier two. So the scientific method involves taking a stand. We look at the evidence and then we draw conclusions for that. And the evidence says that there's no supernatural, then that's what the evidence says. Then we also know that science, Western science, has a history of dismissing other perspectives in a negative way, dismissing other cultures as primitive, as dismissing queer people as crazy, and so on. But part of the reason that we know that is the self-correcting tendency of science itself. And I mean science here in the broadest sense of Wissenschaft. And this is, I think, the place where phenomenology can really be quite valuable as a space that brings social sciences into contact with the empirical sciences, the hard sciences. So a practice that seeks the universal without being reductive, or at least to paraphrase Einstein's dictum, to reduce as far as we can, but not further. By acknowledging the different standards of different levels of analysis, we can do justice to phenomena as lived, yet also appreciate them more dispassionately. Then this brings us to the second question. Is it essential to reconcile any contradictions between these levels of analysis? And my answer to the first question suggests maybe not. But then also accepting all perspectives as equal is also a kind of view from nowhere, because it presumes to stand outside, has the luxury of withholding judgment. And this itself is not a natural sense. It implies a studied expertise, rational analysis, kind of higher order perspective. So viewed this way, it's not a view from nowhere at all. It privileges a view as if from nowhere, or as being slightly more equal than others. So a little bit paradoxical that neutral perspectives are themselves perspectives. Perhaps this contradiction is the clue to reconciling the bigger picture. The fact that there are multiple perspectives is also part of the truth. And the fact that we can discuss, share, synthesize perspectives is also part of the truth. And this sense of dialogue, I want to suggest, offers the most productive way of dissolving the problem. Now, if we look at the different perspectives as languages, we can see that synthesizing perspectives is a matter of translation. As we all know, translation rarely works in a one-to-one sense. Languages all have their own histories, they have their own backgrounds, tacit knowledge, ways of framing the world. So accurate communication across languages usually takes some form of back and forth, some form of zeroing in. And language in this bigger hermeneutic sense that I want to use it also includes the languages of science and the languages of phenomenology. These are essentially derived languages. So they too have specific histories, vocabularies. They require immersion in a certain form of life to be truly understood. So as derived languages, they aren't necessarily as privileged or as neutral as we tend to assume they are. But by being conscious of that, I think can help us make phenomenology more engaged by accepting that perhaps there isn't a final answer, but treating the process itself as the goal. So translating experience into phenomenology isn't a one-way street where we experts somehow have a better grip on experience itself, but neither is a lived experience unquestionable. So the interview is actually an ideal format, I think, for doing phenomenology, because it asks both researchers and subjects to make an effort and to work together to clarify contradictions.
Moving into the Q&A time.
Sure. I have one more sentence. So in a truly collaborative process, both parties will find themselves changed. And so I think it's through such back and forth, through the questioning and answering, that we work with subjects in order to zero in, redefine, and then think together in a new and shared language what it is that we are. Yeah. So thank you for your attention.